Hello and welcome to the December 15th edition of Ukraine Without Hype. I'll be doing this again on my own until logistical issues sort themselves out better. Romeo will be back. Just it's hard, but I am Anthony Bardaway. Although Romeo cannot be here to say it himself, he did ask me to pay respects to a friend of his who was killed fighting in the Bakhmut area. Evhen was a musician. Romeo wanted to highlight that he'll miss his music very much. So, Evhen Podkovka, may your memory be a blessing, and may your blood be avenged. So just a quick, personal update here. Personal as in what's affecting me directly, as opposed to the country as a whole. The electricity situation in Kyiv has been improving. Last week was kind of a wash, as was the week before, where electricity kind of came on when it could. And other than that, was you just had to figure it out. This week, however, were able to switch back to a schedule of some kind. This included only 4 guaranteed hours of electricity, but then a whole lot of flex time. So you go to the DTEC website, the energy services company's website, you type in your exact address, and it will tell you, here is when you'll have your electricity back. And here's a whole big gap of time where it may be back, it may not. We'll see how it goes. And I'd say that for most of the week, it has tended towards being on rather than being off, though it was still quite unreliable as to when it would be. Of course, that is all very dependent on when the next Russian attack will be. And it always is coming. Historically, it happens once every 2 weeks. So we're kind of getting to the point of being on schedule again. So maybe the dreaded day of Monday will be when it comes. You never really know. But until then, I have been enjoying a longer period of electricity. There has been an attack on Wednesday of a series of suicide drones on Kyiv. However, 100% of them were shot down. The efficacy of anti-air defenses has been improving over time to the point where, well, it was always most of these drones were shot down, but it is getting closer to that 100% mark. Although, again, all it really takes is one to get through air defenses to cause a serious disruption if that one hits something especially vulnerable, such as a major power substation. And, of course, that is only talking about Kyiv. Many of the most southerly, the Black Sea cities, have been much more in trouble. Odessa has been without power for quite a bit now. Mykolaiv, again, very precarious. Kherson has nothing. As we went over, the Russians destroyed the electricity infrastructure before they retreated from Kherson. So restoring anything to that city is exceedingly difficult. This has led to many of the people who were trapped in the city during the occupation to then, now is the time for them to flee, because it's just an unlivable city. When Odessa, under normal circumstances, is significantly more comfortable than Kherson, at least, I'd say it still is, even considering the power outages, or further on to, you know, Kyiv, Lviv, the normal places for internally displaced persons to go. But I think talking about Kherson is a good segue into talking about the combat update. The Russians have been hitting Kherson pretty hard, with artillery, rockets, etc. Kherson had been largely preserved up until this point, just because the Russians were able to take it with relative ease, I should say. The battle there was not as intense as it was for Kharkiv or Kyiv, even. just because, well, it turned out the local authorities there had quite a bit of moles and turncoats and traitors in their midst that made the battle much harder for the Ukrainians to fight. So there wasn't much damage coming in because the battle was so short. And of course, Ukraine was not interested in shelling their own city during the long battle where the front line was in between Kherson and Mykolaiv. And because Russia was able to withdraw in reasonably good order and without putting in urban fight, Ukraine was able to retake Kherson without much of a fight going in. So throughout all these months, there just weren't many opportunities for Kherson to be hit. But now that has changed. Now it is very much the front line on the Ukrainian side against the Russians. Again, just over the Dnipro River, and the Russians are hitting it like they used to hit Mykolaiv, or still hit Mykolaiv, but Kherson is the new Mykolaiv as far as the front line is concerned. In addition to being the target of many of these artillery and rocket attacks, there have been a large number of investigations into Russia's torture chambers that they were able to use in Kherson, both the city itself and the larger deoccupied territory. And as it's been feared, because Kherson was really an actual regional center, the Russian oppressions there seem to actually be worse than they were than even many of, for example, in Kharkiv region. The torture regime seemed to be much more organized in order to control this larger population. And there seems to have been torture chambers specifically set up for children. The people who lived near these torture chambers seem to have known about them to at least some extent. They knew that that is where children were disappearing to. Many bodies, dead bodies, have been found next to these torture chambers, including a 7-year-old who had been gang raped before being murdered. So we were talking about how wherever Ukraine is able to regain control of territory, these grisly findings are found. And we had talked about how, because Kherson was such a center for resistance, and because it really was the one regional center they're able to take, this was to be expected, but you still, it being confirmed always has that very grim feeling behind it, which once again backs up the point that all these people calling for quote unquote peace, what they mean by ceding territory to Russia is allowing 7-year-olds to be gang raped and murdered. And that is what I hear when someone calls for capitulation and giving up territory, like it is just some empty space on a map of risk. Territory is not territory. It's the people who live on that territory. So if I hear you say, have negotiations where Ukraine cedes territory, what I'm hearing from you is you want more 7-year-olds to be gang raped. And there's no honor or decency in that stance. Looking elsewhere, and the main show is Bakhmut. Of course, because this has been the case for so long, I don't need to go into too much detail. You've heard it all before from me. But there seems to be in new intelligence that what Wagner is doing in Bakhmut is essentially sending in its convict soldiers, its people that it recruited from prisons, using them as bait, more or less. When they send these soldiers in, they don't especially care if they live or die, but they have then their more experienced and valuable to them soldiers standing in the back, watching where the artillery and other shots are coming from the Ukrainian side. So the old, you know, war movie trick of holding the helmet up above the trench to see where they'll shoot the helmet from, Except in this case, there is a human skull within that helmet attached to the rest of a human body. Then, once they're able to use these mobilized soldiers and convicts as bait to find out where these shots are coming from, they can then do counter-battery fire. Which, of course, leads to very high casualties on the Russian side, as well as the Ukrainian side, just because the battle is so vicious. Now, the lines around Bakhmut have largely been unchanged. If you look at the map, they'll just be, you know, inches gained on either side at various times. It's positional warfare, but the positioning is so small that it's hard to even describe it without, you know, literally just showing you a series of maps where the line of contact or line of control kind of dances in between on a day-to-day basis. Again, audio format has its limitations without being able to show this data in visual format. But just know that this positioning is very bloody and very small, kind of like how you would hear people describe World War I of throwing an entire village's worth of young men to gain a few meters. It's not quite to that extent, but just take what you know about World War I and you kind of know what Bakhmut looks like. That said, it seems as though the Russians have been trying to reposition how and where they'll try to flank Bakhmut. Ultimately, what they want to do is to surround it to a certain extent in order to cut it off from supply. Though that is especially difficult now because the front line basically is one vertical line from the Russian border to the north down pretty far into Donbass. So having any kind of encirclement, it's not like how it was during the battle for Severodonetsk, where the Ukrainians were trapped into this fairly large salient that's all flattened now and has been for months. So the prospects of doing an encirclement are extraordinarily difficult, though Wagner continues to try. They have been moving towards Soledar to the north of Bakhmut, though Soledar has been holding. And they've been trying to the south in various places. And it seems like they've had slightly more success in gaining some ground to the south of the city. Meanwhile, however, the Ukrainians have launched a larger HIMARS campaign, which had been used to a lesser extent since the battle for Kherson. They're just trying to figure out where to reposition things. But Bakhmut is priority number one at the moment, so of course many are going to Bakhmut as long as other reinforcements. But for example, they were able to use a HIMARS assault to destroy a Wagner base in Kadivka, Kadivka being one of the staging areas that the Russians have been using to attack Bakhmut. So an unknown number of people were killed in this attack on this Russian Wagner base. But other intelligence shows that they have been significantly damaged by HIMARS, artillery, and other long-range attacks behind the lines of Bakhmut into their staging areas, again, like Kadivka. Other HIMARS attacks have been hitting around Melitopol. A barracks next to Melitopol, Russian barracks next to Melitopol, was destroyed, and with an unknown number of Russian soldiers killed in that attack. And speaking of Melitopol, the Melitopol partisans have been extremely active recently. This included destroying one of the major bridges leading out of Melitopol. That was a very serious supply line leading from Crimea eastwards, like controlling that highway running west to east in the far south of the country. There are still, of course, other routes. This doesn't mean that Russia can't transport anything, but that was still an important bridge, and it shows that they're still very active despite the crackdowns. They're also able to assassinate a member of the Melitopol occupation authorities, along with quite a few other attacks. This has been a very busy week for them. The partisans for Kherson region were also able to do an attempt on the deputy governor of occupied Kherson region, though he was able to survive the car bombing, unfortunately. So moving away from talking about direct fighting to other violent incidents that occurred outside of Ukraine, actually, there was a mail bomb to the Ukrainian embassy in Spain, which thankfully did not kill anyone, but it did explode. There were other suspicious packages sent to Ukrainian embassies and consulates elsewhere. Many, many Ukrainian embassies received packages containing dead animal parts. These were mostly animal eyes, seemed to be a popular one. Dog eyes, in many cases, it seems, which seems to suspiciously correspond with a bunch of dead dogs being found in the Astrakhan region of Russia who had their eyes removed. So other than the Spanish embassy, most of these were more of a nuisance than anything, you know, directly violent. But there's just something very grim about sending these bloody eyeballs to all these embassies. It takes a certain type of personality to do something like that, and that's the serial killer personality. And now moving on to more domestic or uplifting topics. The Kyiv District Administrative Court seems to have been disbanded. We'll see how that actually works out, if it actually sticks this time. It's happened before. Long-time listeners would know that we, once upon a time, mostly covered corruption issues and the oligarchs and all that. So you would be familiar with the Kyiv District Administrative Court. I want Romeo to be back to talk about this because that's one of his real passionate topics. So I'm going to put a pin on that, but just know that these guys were all miserably corrupt. And I would assume that if they dug close enough, they would the authorities would find that the members of this court were probably in one way or another bought out by Russia. They are really the holdovers from the Yanukovych administration, so most likely traitors. But again, I want Romeo to be here to talk about that one. And the Nobel Peace Prize was handed out to the team at the Center for Civil Liberties. This was somewhat controversial because this Nobel Peace Prize was also handed out to a Russian NGO as well as a Belarusian one. Now, both of these organizations, the Russian and Belarusian ones, were, I would say, quite worthy of this kind of award. However, the controversy comes in because Ukrainians really did not feel good about always being lumped in with Russians. There is a much larger discussion about this. It's more about Ukrainians and Russians are different. Why does everything always have to come in a package to Western Europeans when it comes to talking about Ukraine? It is quite insulting and belittling, but ultimately the Center for Civil Liberties opted to receive this award because the recognition of doing so and the platform of receiving a Nobel Peace Prize far outweighed, in their opinion. There was some disagreement on the Ukrainian side about this, though I definitely wholeheartedly agree with this decision to accept the award, because the benefits far, far outweigh the costs. And moving on to this episode's headline topic, as it were, the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, and how it seems like it is now going to be banned. Now, I've talked about the Russian Orthodox Church a number of times on this podcast just because it is one of those topics which I tend to pay closer attention to than even some others. I'm, yeah, something of a religion reporter or what have you. But let's start at something of the beginning. Russian Orthodoxy had always been a major pillar of the Russian imperialist project. Russia is Russia, in large part as a way to justify its conquests of Eastern Europe by saying that they are the seat of the Orthodox religion and the lands of the Eastern Slavs. And therefore, it is their responsibility to gather all of these Orthodox peoples under their protection. It is one of the pillars of this Russian identity that they claim encompasses Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, and therefore why these three nations should belong to one state. If we look at the 19th and early 20th century as Russian imperial nationalism, which is a huge topic that I'd love to talk about at some point, but its three pillars were autocracy, orthodoxy, and nationality. So this Orthodox Church was one of the things that held up what it meant to be Russian and why the Russian Empire justified its existence and expansion. So even before the rest of the things I'm about to talk about, just keep in mind that the Russian Orthodoxy had always been very hostile to the idea of Ukrainian independence or nationhood, which is why during the Ukrainian National Republic period after World War I and before Ukraine was reconquered by the Bolsheviks, this short-lived independent Ukraine, in it was a Ukrainian autocephalous church that had questionable level of acceptance from the rest of the Orthodox world, but importantly was not Russian. It was a more Ukrainian answer to Orthodoxy that was not loyal to a foreign power. During Soviet times, the Bolsheviks, of course, were not big fans of religion, and at the start, heavily, heavily persecuted the Russian Orthodox Church. However, once you get into the 1940s, Stalin realized that one of the best weapons to keep the state together was Russian nationalism, and so decided to take the Russian Orthodox Church, which again was being persecuted, and allow it to come back. But as it's allowed to come back, of course, this is Stalinist Soviet Union. So they basically, once again, became an arm of the Russian state. Again, it was already an arm of the Russian state in the imperial period. There was a brief few decades from when it was destroyed in the revolution to when it was reconstituted under Stalin. And then it became an arm of the Soviet government, and an arm of the Soviet government that was particularly attached to the KGB, because what better way to gain human source intelligence than through your local confessor priest? And quite frankly, religion is hard to stamp out of people, and it was better to the Soviets to have an acceptable source of religion than an unacceptable one. Which meant that in Russia, where there wasn't much competition for Orthodoxy, the Russian Orthodox Church was not promoted as much. But in Ukraine, which was more religiously diverse as far as Christianity is concerned, of course, there's still Muslims and Jews, Buddhists, etc., to add to this equation. But within Christianity, in Ukraine, a Christian could be a Catholic, which was illegal. They could be part of this Ukrainian autocephalous church, which I had just mentioned, which was illegal, or they could be a part of the Russian Orthodox Church, which was an arm of the KGB. So they pushed people in certain directions for reasons you can deduce yourself pretty easily. These underground churches were much less liked than the official KGB church. So in Ukraine, this Russian Orthodoxy was promoted more by the authorities. Then you have the collapse of the Soviet Union and Ukrainian independence. Now, as the Soviet Union was falling apart and the writing seemed on the wall, at least in hindsight, Russia started to take actions to make Ukrainian independence more complicated. For example, Crimea had been just a regular part of the Ukrainian Soviet Republic for most of its history, But then, right at the very end, Crimea was made into an autonomous republic, pretty much for no other reason but to be a spoiler for any future Ukrainian state. And the same with the Russian Orthodox Church. They knew that an independent Ukraine might have reservations about their largest religion being controlled from a country they had a dodgy relationship with, although still mostly friendly up until 2014 and again now. So they created a Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate as their outpost in the country, rather than trying to hold on to it directly. It was a local solution that could work within a Ukrainian context, but still be controlled by Russia. And the KGB thing did not go away. The current leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, Gundeyev, is an old KGB officer. This was discovered through KGB archives that were opened up, and really just common sense. Gundeyev, under the Soviet Union, was not just a priest, but on his, you know, ascent through the ranks, he did so as kind of a church diplomat to speak to Orthodox believers in other countries. And everyone knows that the Soviet diplomatic corps was mostly just spies. So now we have this situation in Ukraine, in independence, again, starting from the 90s, where there was the Russian Orthodox Church, and there was a Ukrainian Orthodox Church, one that was actually local. So this one was called the Kiev Patriarchate, as opposed to the Moscow Patriarchate. And then there was, again, the resurrection of this autocephalous church from the independence era, but it was the smallest of the three. So the pre-war status quo was that the Kiev Patriarchate had a larger number of parishioners, people who actually went to their churches, while the Moscow Patriarchate had a larger number of actual properties. And these properties included the more valuable ones, such as the Kiev Pechersk Lavra, which is really the holiest site in Eastern Slavic Orthodoxy. It's a large monastery. I'm actually looking at it from out my window now through the heavy fog, but still see it. It's a very iconic site in Kiev. If you've been here, you've probably gone there because it is so important. So the Moscow Patriarchate controlled the Lavra and the other really important monasteries within Ukraine, the big money getters. So then comes the initial invasion in 2014. And Ukrainian society starts to sour on Russia and other Russian things more than they had beforehand. This led up to eventually a real effort to turn Ukrainian Orthodoxy into something much more official, something much more recognized by wider Orthodoxy. So how is this done? So the Orthodox Church, it's run by various patriarchs, and the first among equals is the one in Istanbul, or as Orthodox still call it, Constantinople, the Ecumenical Patriarch. The Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, this is getting kind of confusing, bear with me, I'm trying to keep it as simple as I can, basically said that he was the one who had jurisdiction in Ukraine, not Russia, and backed this up with various historical arguments, again, all very complicated, but as the actual authority in Ukraine, he then said that Ukraine could have its independence as a formal, recognized Orthodox church that was independent and on an equal playing field with any other patriarch. So this is when the Kiev Patriarchate, as well as the Ukrainian Autocephalous Church, merged together into the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. However, at the time, they did not want to disrupt things too much to the point of having social upheaval. There was some worries about that. There were, you know, young nationalist types who got a bit rowdy, but they didn't really do anything, really. It was just a bunch of like a dozen dumb kids kind of started yelling outside the Lavra. Not anything too interesting, really, but there was a fear of it that nothing, there's a fear of it, but ultimately nothing happened. And it came down to a series of choices. Now you could, a individual parish was allowed to make the choice of being with the Russian Orthodox Church or with the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. And gradually more and more switched over to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. So this was already the larger of the two, but it only grew and grew and grew over the years just because it was much more popular and did not have the Russian stink on it, as it were. But again, the Russians still hold on to these very lucrative properties, such as the Kiev-Pechersk Lavra. Fast forward again to the full-scale invasion of February, and it became very unpopular to be attached to Russia. So all these parishes who are still under the aegis of the Russian Orthodox Church rapidly began switching over to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. Very rapidly. As in, within 2 months of the invasion in February, so these numbers I saw were from March, April, something like well over half of the remaining Russian Orthodox Church churches had become Ukrainian. So for the last few months, they have been hemorrhaging parishioners and supporters and goodwill. This partially has to do with the fact that whenever Russia invaded and took over any plot of territory, the number one collaborators were the Russian Orthodox priests. This would make sense if you think back to what I said at the beginning of the segment of Russian Orthodoxy being heavily kind of reliant on the idea of Ukraine not being real and it all just being Russia. So these priests actively collaborated in many, many places. There are many instances of them having kill lists ready for when a Russian Commissar showed up. He would go to the Russian Orthodox priest. The priest would give him the list of names of people who were more civically involved, who would be more likely to resist Russian occupation. So the Russians could then arrest these people, torture them, and maybe kill them. There's also many instances of Russian priests acting as artillery spotters, of telling the Russians where to shoot in these towns that they're supposedly the priests of. They're guiding missiles towards their own flock. Now, the hierarchs of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, also known as the Moscow Patriarchate, or what they would call themselves is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate, they have tried to survive. They formally cut off many of their ties with the Moscow Patriarchate itself. It's been quite confusing. The statement that they used to kind of declare independence still has not been made public, so we don't know the terms of this independence. They've stopped honoring Patriarch Gundeyev, also known as Kirill, but I call him Gundeyev because that's his actual name. I don't recognize him as a religious authority. He's just a spy. But this attempt to kind of distance themselves from Russia was wholly a matter of PR, it seems, considering how, if they really wanted to, they probably could have clamped down on these lower level officials who were actively collaborating and never did. So just the point here is that for these last few months, since the full-scale invasion, well, everyone's been very suspicious of them. And the tipping point of what led to the recent series of events was that there was a video taken of people in the Kiev-Pechersk Lavra singing a prayer for the unity between Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus. Again, this is very much a part of Russian Orthodox teachings, so it's not too surprising. But you had these people in the center of the Russian church in Ukraine praising the Russian war effort, in so many words, in order to unite the Rus people. This is, of course, very illegal. It is sedition. If they act on these words, which people tend to do, it is treason on top of sedition. So there's a very loud outburst of outrage over this, as you would expect, which led to a series of raids on the Lavra and other church properties to find evidence of collaboration with the Russians. Now, this raid happened shortly before the previous episode, but I kind of wanted to wait to see what would happen because you never know. Stories can fizzle out. So I just wanted to see where it would go to know what I had to talk about. And it turned out that what I have to talk about was that is a series of raids throughout the country in Kyiv, Poltava, Chernivtsi, Zakarpattia. And these raids seem to have been very fruitful. Now, I am suspicious of the SBU, the Ukrainian version of the FBI. It's not entirely impossible that some of this evidence may be a bit more shaky than others. But let's just say it all kind of fits into place that what they found was a lot of Russian propaganda material, passports. Maybe one of the things I'm more suspicious about, but who knows, flags of Novorossiya and the kind of Russian occupation entities. More luridly, there seemed to have been child pornography on a church computer, as well as one priest who was caught in bed with an underage acolyte. So this has all been happening over the last, you know, 2+ weeks, which then led to these findings building a case for the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine not being wholly honest with its claims of opposing the war and, you know, trying to survive as a patriotic Ukrainian entity, which was always nonsense considering the fact that whenever they made these statements, even within these statements, it was usually couched within the language of not wanting to lose any more people than they already had, especially when the parts of Ukraine who have been most affected by the war were the parts of Ukraine where they had the most parishioners, and these parishioners being driven out of these areas where they had more influence into areas they had less influence, including to other countries where they have no influence whatsoever. So even these statements of seeming patriotism were always explicitly couched in the language of, we need to stay alive as an organization. But it seemed as though their strategy for staying alive as an organization was just PR and nothing actually strategic or real. So because all of this evidence of treason was found on the grounds of Russian church properties, there was the decision made to ban the church. Now, this is not quite what it sounds like. There was this kind of Security Council resolution with a lot of these types of laws. Ukraine likes to kind of make the declaration first and come up with the details later. It can be frustrating, but I guess the better way to say it is that the intent to ban the church was broadcast by the executive, by Zelensky and the rest of the government. So these churches are still operating. It still exists, but Ukraine is working out how they can do some kind of legal action that can actually ban the Russian Orthodox Church as an extension of the Russian government, and then how they can strip it of its properties, which is something they have never even thought of doing before this. So the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra is controlled by the Russian Orthodox Church, but really it is a property of the Ukrainian state and only leased to them. So the best way to do that is to just remove the lease, but there's some, you know, legal issues of how to do that fully properly. They're investigating how they can go about that right now. So they made the declaration that they wanted and are now figuring out how to do it within the legal frameworks of the Ukrainian constitutional legal order, which could still take some time. But my guess is that this coming Christmas, which is actually not until January, according to the Old Orthodox Church, not December 25th. So I think this will be the last Christmas for Russian Orthodoxy in Ukraine. It'll take a while to sort out, but by next Christmas, it will all be Ukrainian. So that's what happened and is what's going to happen in the future. But let's get into a little bit of the whys. So why now? I've seen some people ask why the government did this now and not earlier in the war. Some people were questioning why it wasn't done immediately, as in why this wasn't done immediately when the Ukrainian, the Orthodox Church of Ukraine was created. And the answer is it was just not politically or in some ways, in the terms of civil rights, allowable to disband this Russian Orthodox Church. There's still many believers in Ukraine, even though it was a minority religion. While there were many suspicions of the Russian Orthodox Church, it is an old established part of the culture of the country. So it was seen as a thing that was just kind of there and always would be there and not. So even if you had your suspicions, it seemed a bit not right to get rid of it, but to trample on the beliefs and the rights of the believers who were still part of this church. And I wholly agreed with this decision. Like, let it leave it to its own devices and let it sort itself out. But now, with ample evidence of them collaborating with the Russian government in its invasion of Ukraine, and it has really made the case that its existence causes more harm than any feelings that people may have about it. And building off of that, those feelings have largely been destroyed. Like I said, because everyone is so aware of all these crimes, and because they have lost so many of their followers to the point of them basically being vestigial at this point, that no one cares to protect them anymore. And that includes on the highest level. So they did control various politicians that really were there to serve the interests of the Russian Orthodox Church. But the politicians who were the most interested in protecting the Russian Orthodox Church were also the ones who became collaborators with Russia and are no longer part of the Ukrainian government. This included Andrei Derkach. His name may sound familiar because he was Rudy Giuliani's main contact in Ukraine during the whole Ukrainegate scandal, but Andrei Derkach was a spy master for Russia, and early in the war was caught trying to build a saboteur unit within Ukraine on behalf of Russia, and Derkach was one of the Russian Orthodox Church's primary political supporters. So they don't have the high level protection because the high level protection is now on the Russian side and therefore enemies of Ukraine. They don't have popular support. They don't have anything anymore other than their extremely well deserved reputation as collaborators. The Ukrainian government finally reached the point where they said that this church had always been problematic to a certain extent, including because the Pechersk Lavra is something of a hotbed for organized crime activity as well, but it had always been questionable to the state, to the country. But there are many sins built up, and because everyone saw those sins built up, that no one cared to protect them anymore. And that's what a lot of politics comes down to, is how much bad can you do and still have people supporting and protecting you, and how far you can push up against that breaking point. And the Russian Orthodox Church discovered that they stepped well beyond that breaking point, and now they will suffer the consequences for it. I would like to also address some of the propaganda about this. A lot of people overseas have been saying that, oh, Zelensky banned the Orthodox Church in Ukraine No, they banned an Orthodox church in Ukraine, and this Orthodox church has basically no followers anymore. One. Two is an arm of the foreign intelligence services of a country that is currently invading Ukraine for the purposes of genocide. If someone is an Orthodox believer, they have other options. They have other options that, in terms of actual beliefs, in terms of practices, is virtually identical. The Orthodox Church in Ukraine and the Russian Orthodox Church are mostly the same, except for the question of Russian chauvinism. So take your orthodoxy, remove the Russian chauvinism, and there's no problem just going to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. And if you do so, you're not literally supporting the foreign intelligence service of an invading nation. And most people, as in the overwhelming majority, except for a very, very, very tiny number of holdouts by this point, realized this and made that decision. And the other half of this is saying that because Zelensky, who's a Jew, keep in mind. So, like, this element of a Jew banning an Orthodox church really triggered some people, even though Zelensky is not the Ukrainian government. Keep in mind that Ukraine is not a dictatorship like Russia is. This was not a decision by Zelensky. It was a decision by the broader organs of the Ukrainian government who would be making decisions about this kind of thing. But Zelensky, as the face of it, as a Jew, it definitely kind of kicked up some old Orthodox. So there's very much that anti-Semitic element jumping around of defending Christianity from the Jews. And finally, this idea of Zelensky being a Bolshevik, because the Bolsheviks also attacked religion. One, he's not attacking religion. He's attacking this one specific organization, which is actively working for the genocide of its country. So the not religion as a whole. There's still plenty of other options for a religious person, a Christian or an Orthodox person specifically, to go to. But this idea of Zelensky as a Bolshevik especially made me laugh because, again, like I was saying in this my history portion, the Russian Orthodox Church was constituted by Stalin and made up of KGB officers at the start and to a large extent now. So if there's any Soviet legacy, it's the Russian Orthodox Church, not the church or the government actively trying to repudiate this Soviet legacy. So you'll have Twitter accounts and news, quote unquote, news outlets on one hand using the Soviet namings for various places, such as calling Bakhmut Artyomsk, and getting very mad about Ukraine tearing down Lenin statues, then turn around and say that Ukraine is Bolsheviks. Confusing, and to a Russian, they would see no contradiction between being a Soviet and being a Russian imperialist. But especially these foreign supporters of Russia, it really seems to jumble their brains to hear that Russian Orthodoxy and Soviet nostalgism is largely one and the same. But that's just my arguments against some of the nonsense that's kicking around. In the future, we'll be seeing where this goes, what church properties might be able to be repossessed by the Ukrainian state, how many more Russian Orthodox parishes willingly choose to jump over to the Orthodox Church of Ukraine before they can be banned, if there will be legal proceedings against the hierarchs of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, what kind of response there will be to from the broader Orthodox world, especially from the Ecumenical Patriarch, who I mentioned earlier, who is Ukrainian Orthodoxy's big kind of promoter within Orthodoxy, what he says about it, what other churches say about it. I'm keeping a particular eye on the Svetohrysk Lavra, which was occupied by Russia and is now not fully frontline, but pretty close to a frontline position in the Donbass / Kharkiv front. So I'll see what happens with that property, if there's investigations into the people there, considering that the Svetohrysk Lavra was the source of quite a few of the Russian collaborators back in 2014. So it was already one of the more questionable parts of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine. So I want to see if there's any prosecutions involving that. Lots of things to keep an eye on. A lot of people kind of roll their eyes on it, but thank you for listening to my very, I think, drawn out and detailed explanation of this controversy, its history, what's happening, and what will happen in the future. Thank you very much for bearing with me there. But it is quite important because it is highly tied to the Russian view of itself that allows it to justify its invasion of Ukraine. It's very much tied into Russian imperialism and autocracy. So I feel as though this topic has very much been on the back burner for most people, just because most people are not especially religious and don't pay very close attention to religious issues. But it is an important layer, especially when it comes to the grassroots level, where I feel as though many of the people who feel the most connection to this kind of Rusky Mir, this Russian world, do it through some combination of Russian Orthodoxy and Soviet nostalgism. So it's a key part. So you know how I said earlier in the episode that Kyiv was overdue for another missile attack? Well, it happened, and power was knocked out for a few days there. I recorded this episode on Thursday, and after brief windows of electricity where I was able to edit this episode in fits and starts, I'm finally releasing it at midnight between Monday and Tuesday. But you have to play with the hand you're dealt, so there it is. Anyway, if you would like to support this podcast, the best way to do it is just by telling your friends, getting the word out about what we're trying to do here at Ukraine Without Hype. Like, subscribe, ratings, 5 stars, thumbs up, whatever the case may be for what you listen to us on. So I'd now like to take the time to thank our patrons over at patreon.com/UkraineWithoutHype, where you may join us as well. And they are Deborah Grazer, Will Stevens, David Shepard, Giorgio, Vanna Kukratskaya, Anna Karen, Anonymous, Devi, Etine, Sam, Theo, Aiden, Alex Grochmal, Anastasia Nasiak, Barbara, Big Rob, Brianna Rhoda, Chris Bennington, Chris Walker, Crystal Burns, Daniel Spring, David Wall, Deborah Lee, Eric Honnold, Grace Krause, Had to Laugh, Jacob Holm, James Wise, Jennifer Jarvis, Jerd, Justin Devendorf, Kristen Swanland, Laura De Leon, Lev Goldener, Levy Grove, Lati, Melissa Koselko, Noam Hart, Paul Bailey, Randy McNerlin, Sanjay, Scott Gengris, Scott Tokaruk, Steve Bien, Steven Greenberg, Stuart Akers, T. Bart, Thomas Sobiek, Vic, and Victoria Leontineva. Thank you all very much for your support. This week is Hanukkah, so happy Hanukkah to everybody. And it will also be a Western calendar Christmas. So if you celebrate on that calendar, Merry Christmas to you. If you would like to give Ukraine a present, you can always donate to one of many charities. So I'll play you out with the good old song Carol of the Bells, which I'm sure many of you know by now, was originally a Ukrainian carol called Shedrik. So until next episode, Slava Ukraini. Oh.